It was very frustrating. It was so unsatisfying. There were so many words and no answers. I expected to at least get an idea of when I could go home. Tomorrow, the next day, the day after, there was no answers to anything.
Evacuated Malibu residents angry. They're not allowed back in their homes. They vented at last night's Santa Monica High School meeting. An overflow crowd of about 1,000 people turned up. Residents were frustrated that officials offered little information on when exactly they'd be able to return. A few of those restrictions were lifted today, so some of those residents are now back in their homes, but many others are still waiting. KCRW reporter Jenny Hamill was there, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
So were most people there as angry as that guy?
I would say there was an even split, but there were certainly a lot of frustrated people there. But then there were those who were listening to what all the officials from many agencies had to say, frantically taking down notes and writing down the numbers that were being passed out. And I've got to say, there was a lot of information that was given out.
I understand there was also some criticism over how the fire was fought.
Yeah, so this is interesting. This has been something that I've heard. It's been thematic with a lot of the Malibu residents that I've spoken to, not even just last night, but in the conversations over the last 5 days, was there was a perception that the fire department simply wasn't there in the early parts of the fire. Friday was really what ravaged Malibu, that people didn't see fire engines around. And when they did see fire personnel, they weren't doing enough to save structures. That was kind of a criticism that was laid before the officials last night. And LA County Fire Deputy Chief David Richardson reminded these people that they had 300 firefighters, 70 engines at the ready when the Woolsey started going into Malibu. He said in his 30-year career, he had never seen a fire that was faster moving or more vicious than this fire was. He reminded them that the Woolsey essentially rushed down the two major arteries of the Santa Monica Mountains at once and was just completely overwhelming. With you've heard about the firestorms and the fire tornadoes, and I've heard that from residents, that this thing was just not like fires of the past. So the deputy chief said this quickly became a life safety issue.
The organization, the department, our 911 center received multiple 911 calls of people reporting, "I'm trapped, I need help." So what do? Life is our number one priority. We divert resources from protecting your structures to go affect rescues.
So you can kind of sense, Madeline, there's a bit of a defensive quality in his voice because,
kind of,
you know,
there.
You've got all of these residents who aren't necessarily the professionals and the experts, you know, laying a lot of criticism at these fire teams who I think thought they were doing the best job that they can.
Right. And meanwhile, some people just stayed despite the mandatory evacuation order.
I've talked to so many people who were in contact with their neighbors that stayed in subdivisions in Point Doom at Zuma Beach. One woman who I talked to who lives in Paradise Grove, which is that kind of deluxe trailer park that sits between the PCH and the ocean, her husband took her and her 2-year-old child out when the evacuation orders were laid out, but then he snuck back in with his father's fire badge and met up with a bunch of guys who stayed at the park. We're talking about retired firefighters, lifelong surfers, you know, former lifeguards. So you've got this kind of Malibu, individualistic, a bit of machismo, like if fire officials aren't around, we're going to save our territory ourselves. And they essentially stayed up all night on Friday, and the stories are harrowing. They were running around with hoses, going to each end of the park. If they saw a fire, you know, come trying to jump over the PCH, they'd put it out. They'd run to the south end of the park. I guess a tree in the middle of the park caught fire. They put that out. And the woman that I spoke to said that they did that all night long. And then the next day, on Saturday, friends started bringing in supplies via boat up to Malibu to give them resources. They made a Costco run. They were bringing them food, masks, beers, you know, what they needed.
From the ocean, because they couldn't go through on the PCH.
Right. They weren't allowed to go up the PCH. Yeah. So they were, and then you'd have surfers who would, you know, ferry some of that stuff in.
On their surfboards.
Yeah.
What a California scene.
Right. What a Malibu scene.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just that park. There's lots of subdivisions where I've heard that happen. And the sense that they gave me was, we saw it as a no-option decision. You know, there were no other options. If the fire officials weren't going to save our homes, we were going to do it.
Wow. Okay, there has been a lot of criticism about Pepperdine University's decision to shelter its students in place instead of evacuate them on Friday.
Yeah, there is a lot of people that I have spoken to who really question the decision of Pepperdine University students, all 3,000 of them, being told to shelter in place rather than evacuating, just like all of the residents had to do. One of those residents that I talked to who felt this way about the Pepperdine decision was William Mudd, actually a guy who lost his home in the Woolsey Fire.
You know, I don't know all the facts, but what I've heard that the student stayed is what I've heard, and that the president made that, you know, Pepperdine made that decision, and that forced resources there, and I think that's sinful.
Sinful?
Yeah.
This is a Christian university. Is that why you use that word?
No, I don't know. Yeah, maybe that's the reference. There is also kind of this deeper conspiracy theory about the Pepperdine decision that actually the administrators of the university wanted to save the campus. And so by making all the students stay, then you knew the firefighters were really going to keep that campus safe because you had 3,000 people to consider. So there's a lot out there in the ether.
I guess I'm just wondering about the wisdom of the decision from the student's perspective, because what if the fire, as you described it, it's nothing like any firefighter has seen before. What if it had overcome Pepperdine and there are 3,000 students sitting there? Well, why didn't they try to evacuate them when the roads were still open?
I think there was a sense, at least from what I've heard from officials and administrators, that the campus is pretty safe and has a lot of fire retardant buildings. And it is something that has been pre-discussed between officials and administrators at the campus, that this is kind of a sound decision that we're going to make, is rather than have 3,000 18 to 20 year olds scramble out of the campus, a lot of them with no vehicles because they're in college. I did speak with a resident. I think it's important to hear from someone who supported the decision. Her name is Nadine Morrow. I spoke with her and her friend.
They have their own water. They have power. They have generators. They're responsible for kids. And there was no way out. It was multiple hours to the south to get out of town. It would have not helped.
Where were they supposed to go? Their children that are alone for the first time. It's crazy.
All right. So lots of different opinions about the various decisions that, you know, are made under stressful conditions and fast-moving conditions.
And I think it's important to recognize that, too. These are people who are incredibly emotional right now. They have gone, you know, the most stressful time of their life, many of them who have lost homes. And so, you know, they're just wrought with pain and frustration and fear. And so I think what we're hearing and seeing a lot of that right now.
All right. Jenny Hamill, reporter for KCRW. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Let's look at politics now. A week ago, the blue wave by the Democrats looked a little bit more like a blue ripple. But now, as more late ballots are counted, Democrats are flipping more House seats here in California. They could win as many as 40 nationwide. And that would be the biggest gain by Democrats since Watergate. After Nixon resigned, Democrats picked up 48 seats. In Orange County, speaking of Nixon, all the seats they went after are now within reach. Some tight races are still being counted. Orange County, once considered the national headquarters of the GOP, now the center of the blue wave. Here to talk about the state of the Republican Party in California is Jimmy Camp, former Republican strategist in Orange County. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, so are you a former Republican strategist because you saw the writing on the wall?
Well, I did see the writing on the wall, but I left the party when Trump became the nominee.
Okay, so you thought this is not the party for me.
No longer the party for me. Reagan once said it about the Democratic Party. I didn't leave them, they left me.
So that appears to be the sentiment amongst many of your fellow Orange County voters.
It is. You know, we've seen an uptick of independent voters, a lot of Republicans that have re-registered as independents in Orange County. And I think we're seeing the effects of that really in the last week of what the blue wave is becoming.
And so when we're sifting through the results and the exit polling and all that, is it pretty much that people are now associating the Republican Party with Donald Trump and they don't like that? Or are they voting for other reasons?
The prime indicator that we see is Trump. If you look at the districts in Orange County, which I think it's very likely that for the first time that I've ever, is that there will be no congressional representatives Republican in Orange County. It'll be completely represented by Democrats.
And so is that really shocking to you?
It's very shocking. I mean, we've seen the writing on the wall for years. If you go back 30-plus years when Reagan was running for his reelect in 1984, he beat Walter Mondale by about 50 points in Orange County. Orange County was almost 80% white at that point, and it was considered the most Republican county in the country. You fast forward to the election in 2016, and for the first time since 1936, a Democrat running for president got more votes than the Republican. Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by 100,000 votes in Orange County in 2016.
Yet, in state races, or at least the race for governor, John Cox beat Gavin Newsom in Orange County.
He did, and it's interesting. If you go back again to the 2016 election, while Hillary Clinton beat Trump in Orange County by 100,000 votes, the races for Congress in Orange County, the Republicans were still sticking with their congressional member. For example, in the 45th, Mimi Walters won her election in 2016 by 17 points. Same exact number with Dana Rohrabacher in the 48th. He won by 17 points. And with 2 years of President Trump, we've seen that flip.
What about Josh Harder beating Jeff Denham in the 10th District in Northern California?
Well, that's always been a very competitive seat. There's always been a race up there. So that wasn't as surprising as seeing Orange County go blue. It's interesting. You mentioned John Cox, who got more votes than Gavin Newsom here in Orange County. The top vote getter running statewide in Orange County was actually Steve Poizner, who was running as an independent for insurance commissioner. He got 450,000 votes, about, I think, 50,000 votes more than John Cox.
Interesting. But he also seems to be losing to Ricardo Lara.
Yes, he definitely is statewide losing. But in Orange County, he was the top vote getter. Also, the second top vote getter wasn't a candidate. It was the proposition. Orange County voted to repeal the gas tax, which was Proposition 6. That was the second highest vote getter. So what we saw is voters in Orange County were voting fiscally conservative. They wanted to get rid of the gas tax. They voted for an independent over the Democrat, but when it came down to their congressional races, they ended up voting with the Democrat.
So given that split ticket voting, do you think that these Democrats can rest assured that they will hold the seats from here on out, or are they going to have a fight on their hands 2, 4, 6 years from now?
I think it's going to be a few years. I think the brand is so damaged with Donald Trump that it's going to take years for the Republican Party to climb out of that. I think if the candidates in these four congressional districts in Orange County, if they sort of stay to the center and they don't follow the path nationally that the Democratic Party is going, which has been to the very, very progressive sort of Bernie Sanders type of party, but if they stay more centrist, then they'll get reelected.
And what about statewide? What does this mean that effectively we are in a one-party state?
Just in congressional members, I think we end up with 8 Republican congressional members in California. That's out of 53 seats. Republicans don't hold any statewide offices. And, you know, we've seen talk about this in the press in the last few days, is that the Republican Party is dead in California.
And dead for a while?
I think so. Anything could happen. But as long as the Republican Party is still clinging to Donald Trump, there isn't hope for a long time in California.
But California, in terms of California politics, this has been a Democratic state for a long time, but since before Trump.
Sure.
Effectively, in Sacramento, Democrats have ruled. They didn't have a supermajority in both houses, which they do now, but they were in control of the legislature and the governor's mansion. So does that indicate to you something else besides just the anti-Trump animus?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is sort of demographically the changes that have occurred in California. But it's gone above and beyond that. The Democrats didn't have a supermajority this last election. They've just gotten the supermajority. At one point, Republicans were in play as far as statewide races go. I mean, Schwarzenegger was elected governor as a Republican. Now, he was a different kind of Republican, more of an independent Republican. But it's really been the last 3 or 4 years that it's really gone. And I think the election of Trump and the party embracing Trump kind of put the nail in the coffin.
Jimmy Camp, former GOP strategist in Orange County, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Coming up, Robert Reich is here to talk about what Amazon's HQ2 decision says about politics in America next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. After a year-long search that threw hundreds of American cities into a bidding frenzy, Amazon made a predictable choice for its new headquarters, or choices, I should say. New York City and suburban D.C. will split the expected 50,000 jobs. Amazon's decision has sparked a larger conversation, though, about a growing opportunity divide in the United States. Big international cities that already have a lot of wealth and opportunity keep getting more of it, while the rest of the country falls further behind. Here to talk about this is Robert Reich. He teaches public policy at UC Berkeley, and he was President Clinton's labor secretary. Welcome back.
Hi, Madeline.
Also joining us, Ned Hill, professor of economic development at The Ohio State University in Columbus. Hi.
Hello, Madeline. It's a pleasure to meet you by phone and telephonically.
Okay. Well, great to have you, too. Let's begin with you. Columbus was a finalist for Amazon's HQ2. Are you happy or sad that the city lost out on the bid?
Oh, I am completely stuck in neutral. I don't care. being part of the bid, the bid process brought the economic development community together, increased the visibility of the labor market, and also really drew the university and the larger economic development community together. So that was all great. On the other hand, we avoided, even though it's supposed to be performance-based, a whopping big subsidy that would have caused some real labor problems with J.P. Morgan Chase that has a huge technology center and data security programming center here in Columbus. So I would just as soon, let the market grow and work with smaller companies than just bet on a big fat racehorse.
Okay. Well, Robert Reich, what does that say to you in terms of where America is headed with the smaller cities not wanting to really or not really getting the opportunity to bet on a big fat racehorse?
Well, it just furthers inequality in the United States, inequality of income and wealth and political power, already a huge problem. But we are seeing that the big mega urban centers along the West Coast and the East Coast, even though the cost of housing and rents and living much, much higher than the hinterlands, nevertheless continues to attract big companies, particularly high-tech companies that are in the knowledge business, because these big megalopolises along the East and West Coasts, that's where a lot of the knowledge work is now being done. A lot of knowledge workers, people with college degrees in technology, kind of in the creative and idea-generating parts of the economy, they are all, or not all of them, obviously, but many of them are being attracted to these, San Francisco and Boston, L.A., Washington, New York. And as a result, much of the rest of the country is being left behind.
Mm. Well, I guess it's, as Ned Hill said, maybe a dubious blessing because New York is shelling out some $3 billion in subsidies. And as you say, housing costs are already high. They will surely go higher, at least in the Long Island City part of New York City, with all this added, all these added people in there driving up the cost. So is it really such a great thing that New York has this new HQ2?
For New York and for Washington, not necessarily such a great thing. I think, first of all, those subsidies are ridiculous. I mean, Amazon doesn't need those subsidies. And the idea of particular cities or states providing gigantic tax subsidies to companies that are already in the United States and will decide between two cities in the United States is just a giant zero-sum game. I mean, these cities would do much better putting that money into education and infrastructure and job training and actually improving the productivity of their workers instead of just giving the money away to big corporations.
Right. So,
Matt, let me just jump in just for a second. I've been paying attention to this for a while and have talked to a number of the teams in the Midwest that put in bids. And I'm convinced that Amazon changed course partway through the search, and that's the reason why it took so long. If you read the bid documents, they're very concerned about housing costs. They're very concerned about their personnel costs. And they were really showing this as being much more of a back-office operation, similar to when it ended up in Nashville. And what they ended up doing was putting the headquarters in two of the three cities for which they already have a large amount of headquarters employment within the subsidiaries. Austin, of course, we're all familiar, has Whole Foods, actually four. Las Vegas has Zappos. But we forget that the second largest center of employment for AWS, their web services company, was already in Fairfax County, Virginia. The Audible division is in Newark. Mm-hmm. There's another division that is on the Jersey side. And Amazon had about 2,000 employees already in New York dealing with advertising and fashion. So, frankly, I don't think they're going to get 25,000 people. They're going to get repackaged plus a little bit. And I think that what Amazon really did was I really think they were looking at second-tier, cheaper places that had excellent air service, which would have rolled out Columbus, Indianapolis, and Pittsburgh. But then when they found the depth of programming and technical talent in New York and in D.C., I think they frankly just doubled down.
Right.
And they're going to be screaming about operating costs before the next 5 years are out.
Right. Okay. But take a step back and look at the macro picture for places mm-hmm. like Columbus and what Robert Reich was saying in terms of these big coastal cities increasingly pulling ahead by attracting these high-paying jobs and companies and corporate offices, and the Columbuses of the world not mm-hmm. getting them. What does that mean in the big picture for a place like Columbus?
Well, I think that what we've learned, in fact, we've learned this with our relationship with Chicago, which is the headquarters city of the Midwest. We have to practice Jerry Garcia economics and grow our own. That once when you get a headquarters operation that's fully mobile, a lot of times, yes, we'll say it's talent and workers, but frequently it's air connections. So when we lose a headquarters bid in Columbus, or I lived in Cleveland for 30 years, what we'd find is we would lose it because of international air connections and connectivity. And the question was, with a headquarters operation, was how much of the globe can get to in a 24-hour business trip? And when you have to spend 2 hours on each leg hanging around an airport, that's half of a business day, and that kills us on headquarters searches.
Right. How do you think it contributes to politics in Ohio?
It's clear that we've got a similar problem that the nation has, and that most of our development is along something called the I-71 corridor, the 3C corridor. That's Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, with mostly Columbus and Cincinnati. And it is the former factory towns and the courthouse square towns, which used back from 1890 to about 1970, may have had a local headquarters there that's emptying out. And so our big challenge is, one, how do you improve human capital and education outside the I-71 corridor and away from Wright-Patt Air Force Base? And also, how do we, as public policy is helping growth along I-71 or the coast, how do you recycle or land an abandoned building so you don't end up with 50-year-old abandoned structures for 50 years that dominate these towns?
And Robert, I'll give you the last word here. We have about a minute left. What do you think this is going to do and say? What does it say about our politics and our red-blue divide?
Well, I think it exacerbates the red-blue divide, Madeline. I mean, the divide in American politics that Donald Trump has exploited, obviously, is understood, I think, rather easily in these economic and cultural terms. I mean, on the one side, you've got these big mega urban clusters centered around technology of the future on the East Coast, on the West Coast, that are getting more and more democratic over time. And on the other hand, you've got these great expanses of relatively open space inhabited by people who feel that they are left behind. They're getting older than the median American. They are relatively less educated than a lot of the coastal people. They are also whiter, less diversified. And so that really is the big split in America, and I think a lot can be explained. By the way, another consequence is you've got more distortion in our democratic system because you've got these big megacities in California, a state now inhabited by about almost 40 million people, and yet you've got places like Wyoming and North Dakota that have, what, 500, 600,000 people. They each get two senators.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. You're getting...
We saw that play out in the midterms, for sure.
It really is a kind of, a gerrymandering by state.
Robert Reich, he served as Labor Secretary under former President Clinton, and he teaches at UC Berkeley Public Policy there. Ned Hill, Professor of Economic Development at The Ohio State University. Thank you both.
Thanks, Madeline.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
Coming up in the program, why reading on a page is different than reading on a screen.
I think it's an empathy engine, and I think that that's really essential to me, and I think essential to us, in the sense that you read a book that comes out of some other person's consciousness, you're actually kind of, you're communing directly with their consciousness.
A case for books, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. With all the digital distractions around us, it's difficult to stick your head in a book and keep it there for very long. You read a few lines, then you get a text, you check your Instagram, and then, oh yeah, where were you? Well, don't feel bad. Even my next guest, a man who has devoted his life to books, says he does the same thing. David Yulin is former book critic for the Los Angeles Times and author of The Lost Art of Reading, Books and Resistance in a Troubled Time. Hi.
Hey.
Okay, this book is a reissue of a book that you wrote it 8 years ago.
Yeah, it came out. The original edition came out in 2010. It was based on an essay I had written for The Times when I was book editor there, which came out, I think, in 2009, where I basically wrote, from sitting in that position, wrote an essay saying, I am having a lot of trouble staying in a book. There's too much cultural noise. I don't know what to do about it. I went back and forth about publishing that essay because I felt like it was publishing, you know, a public letter of resignation.
It's like heresy for a book critic to write that.
Yeah. But I had a really good editor there who said you should do it. If you're feeling it, everybody must be feeling it. And it might be useful for people to see that someone who reads for a living is having trouble doing it also. So I wrote that essay. It got a ton of response. And then I ended up expanding it into a book. And then the book is just reissued with a new introduction and a new afterword.
Okay. So I want to talk to you about this experience you had with your son. He was, I think, a freshman in high school when he was assigned The Great Gatsby.
Right.
And here you are saying, yes, one of the great novels of our time. And so he delves into it and he comes back and he says, this is the worst.
Yeah. He says literature,
essentially.
He says literature is dead. None of my friends like it.
Literature or the book?
Literature and reading, uh-huh. Which was a kind of an exaggeration on his part because his best friend at that time was an obsessive Kurt Vonnegut fanatic, which I found kind of interesting. My son has never been a reader.
Is that an act of rebellion against his book critic dad?
It may be. I mean, he's visual, right? He's a lighting designer, so he's a visual artist, but he thinks visually. He was never a reader. I mean, one of the things I had to learn as he was growing up was that that was fine, right? That reading was my thing, but it didn't have to be his thing, and that he could be engaged and connected in all sorts of ways that didn't necessarily involve him spending a lot of time with books. As he's gotten older, he's now 24. He's not a book reader, but he's an obsessive news junkie. So he reads a lot of, he reads a lot, but he doesn't read a lot of books. So I was excited because he was reading this great book And, you know, I thought, okay, we finally can have this conversation about this great book. But because he wasn't really a reader, the annotation process that the school was asking him to do, which was essentially to kind of annotate in the margin as he was reading, was keeping him out of the book. And so I, being the overbearing father that I am, was like, I'll help you. This will be fine. It'll be our project together, which he had absolutely no interest in, but I imposed myself anyway. And that became part of the sort of narrative spine of the book, the sort of the misadventure of reading The Great Gatsby with my kids.
Right. But he did have a point, you admit, about literature being dead.
Oh, I think he had a point about, not about literature being dead, but about its lack of primacy in a certain sense, mm-hmm. right? Like, those of us who are sort of immersed in reading culture, we want it to be a moral good in some way. It makes you a better person. You know, we want to, you know, everybody should immerse in. There was a golden age of reading when everybody sort of talked about the latest novel, and we don't live in that time anymore. And talking to him, I realized that that was never really true, right? When I was in high school in the late 70s, I was really one of a few of my friends who would spend a Saturday afternoon stretched out on a couch reading a novel. Most of them were like out at the park or doing something else. It wasn't like I was part of a group of, you know, 100 kids and we all were reading Proust, right? Mm-hmm. That was not happening.
Yeah.
So I had to really rethink kind of my position about the primacy of reading. Then I started to think about, why is reading important? You know, why does it matter to me, first of all? And how does that extend outward, perhaps, to other people? And that was really useful for me in terms of thinking about my own relationship with it, particularly at that time when distraction was really encroaching on my ability to sort of sit inside a book for a while.
So why is it important to you? You've had a long time to mull this over and think about it.
Well, for me, it's a couple things. One is, I think it's an empathy engine, and I think that that's really essential to me, and I think essential to us, in the sense that you read a book that comes out of some other person's consciousness, you're actually kind of, you're communing directly with their consciousness, right? Their words are kind of inhabiting your brain, and you, conversely, are kind of animating that language as you read it, right? In the book, I quote Vonnegut, who says, literature is the only art in which the audience performs the score, which is a metaphor I really love. And so that kind of one-to-one connection with another mind across culture, across time. If I read, for instance, The Confessions of St. Augustine, right, I'm in a direct one-to-one conversation with Augustine, who, you know, died 1,700 years ago. I mean, this is sort of, it's not rocket science, but I think this is really important, especially now, even more so than when I wrote the book originally, in a society, or I think actually a global society, where we are so entrenched in our own singular narratives, whether individually or our tribe, right? Mm-hmm. Right wing, left wing, whatever, where there seems to be no blurring of the lines or conversation between competing narratives. I think literature offers a way to have a conversation with other narratives and other souls in some way.
But I wonder, can't you find that same satisfaction in a really good film or a really good documentary?
Absolutely.
And the empathy, for example, I mean, there are many documentaries that reduce me to tears, and I'm thinking about them for days.
Yeah.
Same with a feature film.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think it's exclusive to reading at all. I think the one thing that literature does that other arts don't do, and I want to preface that by saying there's many things other arts do that literature doesn't do, but the one thing literature does that other arts don't do is put you directly into the consciousness of the artist, right? Because again, you're reading their language that came out of them, so they are actually kind of inhabiting you in some direct way. But there's always that translation process with literature, right? With a film, you're watching it. It hits you viscerally. Mm-hmm. With literature, you're taking in the language and then you're kind of constructing those images, right? You know, I mean, you know, we've all had that experience when you're really lost in a book. It's almost like you're watching a movie on the inside of your head. You mm-hmm. see those characters mm-hmm. moving around. So I think it's just each art has its different effect. But yeah, I think they all are. A great piece of music, for instance, a great piece of visual art, all of it is about stirring up empathy and connection.
David Ulin, his book is called The Lost Art of Reading, Books and Resistance in a Troubled Time. Well, reading not only stirs up empathy and opens us up to different narratives, it actually changes our brains. So what happens to our brains when we no longer deep read, but just skim through pages in between continuous digital disruptions? Or if we read only short blurbs on our phones or other screens? That's what my next guest, Marianne Wolfe, studies. She, like David Yulin, is a lifelong lover of reading. And years ago, she decided to study the science behind it. She is a cognitive neuroscientist, and now she's director of the Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice at UCLA. Her latest book is called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And Marianne Wolfe joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. A pleasure to be in L.A.
Well, it's great to have you in L.A. Welcome to our fair city. What exactly is reading on a screen rather than reading on a page doing to our brains?
What we are doing when we are ordinarily reading, let's say, print, is allocating time to processes that I've been calling deep reading, in which we pull together our background knowledge, make analogy to inference, the scientific kind of method processes that our reading brain does. What happens when we're reading on digital screens is not that we cannot use deep reading processes, but that we more than likely do not, because the screen has two or three characteristics which actually encourage us to skim, to read ever faster. One of them is that we are often on an internet mode in which we are constantly being distracted. So we are indeed moving our attention ever more quickly. We are also unable or less able to go back and check ourselves with the digital screen. This is called recursion. And the brain does that when we're reading print or materials that are really important, because we're checking ourselves.
Wait,
everything
I want to stop you there.
About, yes, yes.
Describe more what that actually entails. Does that mean when you read something and you don't really understand it, you pause and think about it or look it up? What does recursion mean?
That's exactly right. It's called comprehension monitoring. We have an indication. It seems almost imperceptible, but we know what we don't know usually. And we check ourselves. We go back. Now, with the screen, we are encouraged to keep going forward. It's almost as if the screen has become like a video, like something that is constantly moving, and we're moving with it. So it's a difference between reading on print in a way that's reflective and digital screens, which is hastening us along, skipping some of those important critical analytic processes.
You describe how people read on a screen in the form of two letters, an F or a Z.
Yes.
Yes. Can you describe what we're doing when we're doing that?
Oh, Madeline, this is for all of us. This is not just for the children. I'm always most worried about children, but the reality is that there's a lot of new and even older eye movement research that looks at what we are actually doing when we're looking at a screen or our book. And we tend to use an F or a Z pattern when we read. Think about what a Z does. We go across, we word spot down quickly, and then we go to the bottom. Now, we do that to the page on the screen. We even do it to whole articles where we read the beginning and then skim through and go to the very last conclusions. You know, this isn't just about the reading brain. It's what reading does to thinking. And, you know, we have a society in which the skimming, the glut of information we have leads us to go to ever more comfortable, less adjudicated sources of information. And we are skimming those and accepting them, not realizing we're becoming ever more susceptible to false information, less likely to think about the conclusions of whatever things we're reading. So there are what I consider profound implications for the critical analytic power of our citizenry.
Okay, so practical tips. What do you think people should do to try to get some control back and try to relearn how to read well?
Well, the first thing is to always be aware of the purpose of your reading. Each of us have about 50 to 100,000 words we are skimming a day. So we have to filter. So I believe that by asking what is the purpose will help us look at our day's reading, that 50 to 100,000 words, in a different way. I begin each of my days with some kind of text that slows me down. In my particular world, it's meditation plus philosophy and maybe theology or something that for 20 minutes I am delving into something that's requiring me to think. Then the rest of my day, I'm just filtering and I'm reading my email like crazy. At the end of my day, and I would ask everyone to think about what's possible for them, I would set aside 2 hours without screens, if I could do that for everyone, so that we, whether it's a book or whatever we're doing, we're off screen, we're reducing the distractions of our environment, and we are giving ourselves time to actually be our more contemplative selves.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And hopefully this will inspire us all to read a little bit more.
More deeply.
And more deeply. That's Marianne Wolfe. She's author of Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. Coming up, two opposing poles in our culture these days, white nationalism and multiculturalism. We'll talk about that with arts reporter Carolina Miranda next on Press 5. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. American culture is embracing more diverse voices and ideas than ever before, it seems. The first Black superhero blockbuster, Black Panther, was the top-grossing movie this year, and a transgender superhero has joined the cast of TV Supergirl. But we are also experiencing a rise in nationalism and white supremacy. There's been an increase in the number of hate groups and hate crimes. The deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history happened just last month. Well, our favorite art critic is here now to talk about all of this. Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she's here frequently. Hello.
Hello, Madeline.
All right, so you look at this juxtaposition, this tension between our culture and our politics. How is that playing out in the museum world?
Yeah, this was something that really came out of a question I had, which at this time that politics is making me wildly depressed, why is it that I'm very excited about a lot of the art on view? I feel like we are at this moment where there has been a flourishing. There has museums and other arts institutions have been engaging works that tackle race and identity and gender in ways that and on a scale that perhaps we haven't seen in the past and at bigger institutions that maybe haven't gone into these issues in a deep way. And I think it's a combination of factors, one of them very long running, which is that I think since the civil rights movement, there has been a lot of thought at arts institutions around the country about issues of representation and identity and equity, and not just in terms of the artists being shown, but the curators doing the curating and the directors doing the directing and all of those things. And so you're starting to see that people that came of age in that kind of post-civil rights era now achieving positions of power at museums. And they're using that power to organize exhibitions that, you know, engage Native American themes, issues of Black identity, gender and the body, transgender issues in really engaging and visceral ways. Mm. And that is all butting up against the moment of Trump, in which we see this white supremacy that is ascendant. And I think, you know, some of what you see is this long-running phenomenon, but some of what you see, I think, is also a reaction to what's happening politically, that at a time in which hate crimes are rising, I think for a lot of cultural workers, it's that do-or-die moment.
Or the opposite, that this white nationalism is a reaction to what they're seeing in the culture.
Exactly. I mean, that's some of it, too. The much-discussed white lash to the Obama presidency is something that we are seeing now. But I think, you know, the reaction to the reaction, I think is a number of arts institutions saying, okay, now it is time to walk the walk on issues of diversity and multiculturalism because we need it now more than ever.
Okay, one show in particular, Adrian Piper's show, it's at the Hammer. Can you talk about that?
That is a really interesting show and a very difficult show. I feel like I need to go back 3 or 4 more times to fully absorb it. She is a conceptual artist from New York who now lives in Berlin and also teaches philosophy. So her work is very imbued with philosophy, with issues of mapping and the self, and lots of things I can't quite articulate into a mic on short order. But a very difficult artist, a very influential and important artist within the art world, but a very difficult artist, you know, not a big brand name artist. And I think what's significant about the exhibition that you're seeing at the Hammer is that was an exhibition that's being co-presented with the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Museum of Modern Art being one of the bastions, mm-hmm. mega bastions of culture in the United States. So to see a show like Adrian Piper at MoMA, I think is significant. You know, it is a major institution of culture in the United States saying that the ideas that she's presenting, a lot of which touch on race and identity and the vagaries in between, are important and should be studied.
Yeah. And do you look at her work now differently now that we're in this new Trump world?
I think, you know, obviously issues of race have never gone away. Racism has never gone away. White supremacy has never gone away. And so we could say that she's prescient in tackling some of the issues that she's tackling in her work. You know, there's a video installation in the show at the Hammer that deals with the Rodney King beating. There are other issues that deal with pieces that deal with identity and biracial identity. And so we could say that they're prescient. They're kind of not because they're always been there, but I think that they are landing at a moment in the culture in which perhaps more people might be willing to listen and consider those ideas than at any other time.
You have also at MoCA downtown, the Geffen.
Yes.
The Barbara Kruger, huge, I don't know, installations on the wall
outside.
It's a
giant mural on an entire side of the building.
Called Untitled Questions,
yes.
Which seems pretty on the nose in terms of criticizing the current moment, although it was done a long time ago, right?
It was done in the 80s.
Yeah.
It was done in the 80s. Yeah, that's a terrific piece. If you're driving along Temple, you've probably seen it. It looks like a giant American flag. And the questions are written out as the stripes. And they ask, you know, who dies and who prays loudest. And it's a series of very pointed political questions that basically ask who has power and who doesn't.
Who dies first? Who laughs last?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, that piece, when I interviewed her about it, she talked about how she wishes that piece were not still relevant, but in many ways it is. And I think it's interesting that the museum is choosing to resuscitate it right at this moment. And I think it goes back to this ideas of institutions thinking about issues of power and how that plays out in our society. And by reintroducing this piece, it's like reigniting that debate. And Kruger's a very pointed artist in that way. Like, her work has always taken on issues of power in very, very direct ways.
Right. And I think museums have struggled forever for being relevant, of being part of the current world in which they operate and not being kind of, you know,
laggards.
Laggards and ivory towerish.
Yes.
And so do you think that the directors now, the curators now, feel in a sort of a mission to be a little bit more of the moment in terms of what art they present?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly museums are not perfect institutions by any means. They represent the societies from which they emerge, and there are large questions still looming about issues of representation and who gets to direct museums and what artists get shows. You know, it's still a field dominated by white men, both in terms of who's in power and who is being given the solo retrospectives. But I do get the sense, you know, for the story that I did, I spoke to folks like Julian Sugasagoita. He is the Mexico-born director of the Nelson Atkins in Kansas City. Like, he's, you know, a Latino directing a major encyclopedic museum in the United States. And it's so important. Like, the ideas of diversity that sort of he came up with when he was coming up as a curator are so important in terms of how he deploys them in his own museum. And that was something that was shared across the board with a lot of the curators and directors that I spoke with for this story, that feeling that these ideas that we came up with, now is the time
to deploy them. Now is the time to push for the difficult show. Now is the time to push for the shows that explores areas of overlooked history.
And do you see any, I mean, it probably takes a long time to curate a show, obviously,
years. Yes.
But do you see anything in the works or anything being shown right now that directly comments on our political moment in a way that is it's inescapable?
Well, I think, you know, the Adrian Piper show in absolutely subtle ways, I think, does that. And I think if there were one show in L.A. that I would suggest people go and marinate in, that would be a good one.
Okay. Adrian Piper at The Hammer. Thank you very much. Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.